So here is an early photograph of the Orion Nebula. Now, this one is a modern photograph of the same object taken with the Anglo-Australian Telescope. You see the three stars that were sketched by the earlier astronomers, and the group of three here, trapezium, and all of the detail you see in this photograph actually exists in the early drawings. But the emphasis which, with which the various bits are given is quite different in the drawings from the modern photograph. So this is an objective recording. But the human eye only works at a limited range of wavelengths. In the case of Ainslie Commons' early photographs, it was blue that was recorded by the photographic plates because that's the only light they were sensitive to. This happens to have been taken in green light, although it's a black and white picture. If we take photographs at longer wavelengths, we can see rather different things. And certainly in the Orion Nebula, you can do that too. Here, for instance, is the same... Ah, sorry, I forgot about that. What we can now do is to photograph this part of the sky in colour. I shall talk about colour photography a little bit later on. If you photograph the Orion Nebula in focus, in two different wavelengths, you can see different things. Here is a photograph taken in blue light. We can see these bright blue stars here. In fact, it's the light from these stars, the short wavelength ultraviolet light, that makes all this stuff glow, because this is gas between the stars, and in fact it's the gas from which these stars have recently formed. Anyway, these are blue stars emitting large amounts of blue and ultraviolet light. This photograph was taken in very near infrared light, just a bit longer than red wavelengths, and you can see something very different about them. You can see many more stars here than you can in this photograph. Because it's an interesting fact about infrared radiation that it penetrates dust, obscuration, much more easily than does blue light. So these two photographs show what can be done with photography. But photography runs out of steam a little bit beyond the red visible end of the spectrum. Just where the, if you look through a spectrum of light, if your eye goes all the way to the red end, the red light seems to fade, and there you start the infrared part of the spectrum, and that's where this photograph was taken. But if you go a bit further along the spectrum to the bits you really can't see, that's where photography doesn't work, and you've got to adopt different ways of taking photographs. It's this area of expertise where David Allen made such a major contribution. This is a photograph made by David Allen, and in fact his colleague Michael Burton, who I'm pleased to say is here tonight, both worked together on photographing the Orion Nebula with an instrument that David had designed, an instrument called IRIS, and this is a result of that kind of imagery. Once again, this group of stars here, the trapezium group, now not so dominant, because they're not especially bright in the infrared part of the spectrum. They're extremely blue stars. But we can see many new things. We can certainly see many new stars we couldn't see before. Also, this picture was made with three different colours, selected so that much of the nebulosity wasn't visible. But you can see new and exciting things. You can see this great red blob here, which isn't obvious on any of the earlier photographs you've seen, and lots of interesting details that are simply missing from the visible light picture. And this was the magic that David Allen created when he designed an instrument for recording these bits of sky. It wasn't quite so simple as photographers have it. It wasn't the case of putting a photographic plate in the telescope and making a picture. This was a very special instrument that was designed to scan these objects in a very clever way and assemble the pictures later on from a series of small individual components. So there's a lot of work in a photograph of this kind. Now, this red blob here is really very interesting, and I think the next slide shows much more detail in that. And this is a very famous picture indeed. In fact, it made the front cover of Nature magazine when the paper describing this discovery was produced. It was called, naturally enough, the Hand of God picture. And it was curiously apposite that this was the last major paper that David Allen produced before he died. It was written with Michael Burton, who's here tonight, and it shows clear evidence of ejection of material from a young star forming here. This stuff is squirted out into space with an enormous velocity. And this instrument not only takes pictures, it takes spectra, and these spectra tell that these greenish-looking tips in this photograph are actually very rich in iron, something that wasn't known about the objects in the Orion Nebula at all. There are all kinds of significances in the fact that there's the element iron here. For example, the Orion Nebula, which produced this lot, initially would be very weak in iron. There'd be not much iron there, but it's been enriched in iron by star formation occurring there since the beginning of the universe. So the presence of iron is really very interesting. And of course, you can also tell by looking at the spectra, the details of the spectral lines here, what is exciting the iron, how much it's excited, and get some idea of the energetics of what's happening in this fascinating star-forming region. So for all those reasons and many others, images like this are extremely powerful ways of understanding astronomical objects. Well, if we now go back to visible light and take a slightly wider angle view of this beautiful star-forming region, here again we can see the little group of stars and the line of three, but now we've taken a slightly longer exposure with the Anglo-Australian telescope and we can see a good deal more detail. And you can see it's a rather beautiful object. So these are 5-minute exposures with the Anglo-Australian telescope. With a wider angle telescope, but still, we can take a photograph that looks like this. And this is the picture taken with a Schmidt telescope, a special wide-angle instrument of the Orion Nebula. A group of stars is now hiding there. Well, these pictures are made in visible light, and they're not made with ordinary photographic film. There's no film that will record the Orion Nebula like this. What we do here is to make 3 separate photographs in red, green and blue light on glass plates, black and white glass negatives. And because those 3 separate photographs contain all the colour information you need to make a colour picture, we take them into the lab and combine the information from them using photographic methods to build up a true colour picture. And this is how the Orion Nebula would look if you were able to turn the gain up in your eye by some large factor. Well, that way of making photographs is very useful, and it has some enormous advantages that colour films don't have, and indeed colour films normally don't need. This, for instance, looks a very boring sort of photograph. It's a negative, of course. These black blobs are stars, and you can just about make out, I hope, a wispy outline of something here, very, very faint. This is the deepest photograph of this object you can make with the Anglo-Australian telescope. And so this object, whatever it is here, is extremely faint. But you can copy this photographic plate, because that's what it was, on high contrast film and enhance the very faint details on it. And so you can find yourself with a negative that looks like this. And now it suddenly becomes rather more interesting. It's got a lot more detail. And of course, from the negative, you can make a positive that looks like that. But because we have 3 negatives taken separately in red, green, and blue light, we can combine them to make a colour picture and produce an image that looks like that. And now it begins to get really interesting, because for the first time, we can say something really useful about the physics and indeed the chemistry of an object of this kind. What we have in the middle of the picture here is a blob of gas and dust. There are lots of these clouds of gas and dust sitting around inside our own Milky Way. And in fact, it's from them that stars form. So they're of enormous interest to astronomers. Normally, if they're not illuminated by anything, you simply don't see them. The only way you know they're there is that they block out the light of stars in the background. This blob of gas and dust, by the way, blob is not quite the right word. There's a lot of stuff here. There's probably enough stuff in this blob to make 20 or 30 stars like the sun. So it's a fairly substantial blob. But what it is a cloud of hydrogen gas, mostly hydrogen gas, and it's associated with relatively few, very tiny dust particles. The dust particles themselves have arisen from stars long before this blob itself formed. But that dust keeps away radiation from other stars. So inside this cloud, it's very dark and it's very cool. Infrared radiation, the heat, can escape, But no visible radiation can get in. And visible radiation is actually quite destructive for objects of this kind. So this is a so-called molecular cloud, called a molecular cloud because on the tiny on the surfaces of the tiny dust particles, molecules begin to form. Molecules of hydrogen, but more often water and ammonia, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, very simple molecules will form on these cold, dusty particles. So, and they can be detected by radio astronomers, so they know they're there. But over here somewhere, out here, way off the photograph, the other side of the room, there is a group of very hot stars. And their radiation is blasting away at the surface of this delicate, cold, dark cloud. Their radiation destroys the delicate molecules, releases gas, most of it hydrogen. The hydrogen itself is then excited by the ultraviolet radiation from these hot stars and glows with a very distinctive colour. This red glow here is hydrogen that's been excited by hot stars nearby. The dust particles blown out of this cloud form a long tail here that goes way off the photograph, and it's blue because the dust particles are very tiny. In fact, it's probably wrong to call them dust at all. They're more like tiny particles of smoke. And if I was a smoker and held up a cigarette in this projector, you'd notice that the smoke appeared to be blue. Not because the smoke is intrinsically blue. Those of you who've blown smoke through a handkerchief know it's a very terrible brown, grungy colour. Smoke is nasty, brown, horrible stuff. But when it's in tiny particles, it's blue. It scatters blue light. And that's what's happening here. There are no smokers out here, I should tell you. But these are very tiny particles, and they scatter the blue component of starlight very well indeed. So this long tail gives these objects their name. This is called a cometary globule. But it has nothing much to do with comets at all. When we look through lots and lots of blue dust, we see blue light, of course. But if there's dust in the way that's not illuminated, as here and here, we get a curious kind of yellow colour, just exactly the kind of yellow colour we see when we look at the sun through bushfire smoke, or when we look at the sun through lots of atmosphere when it's setting. The colour goes deep red, orange colour for just that reason, because the light's being scattered by these small particles. So from this simple, well, not simple, but from this single colour photograph, one can derive a lot of information about objects that are normally quite difficult to study. The other thing of interest here is this. This is an edge-on spiral galaxy. Of course, it is millions of light years beyond our own Milky Way. This object is relatively nearby, a few hundred light years distant. So the importance of colour photographs is in revealing things that you wouldn't normally be able to see and that you can't see on colour film. But the three-colour process I mentioned to you is a fiddle, to be honest. You wouldn't want to make your own family photographs using this process because it takes me several days to make just one. But it is worthwhile, and let me show you why. This picture was made of a patch of sky near the bright star Antares, this star here, a globular cluster, the star Rho Ophiuchus up there near the top of the photograph. It was made on colour film in the 1970s before the three-colour process was working very well at all. In fact, it hadn't really been got going. But we were quite pleased with this photograph. We needed a PR picture, a public relations picture of this patch of sky, and this served us very well for a long time. But when the three-colour process was successful and it began to produce pictures, we went back and re-photographed this patch of sky, same telescope, but instead of using colour film, we used three separate black and white plates taken in red, green and blue, and then combined the image together to make a new picture. And this is the image that we got. Now, it's exactly the same bit of sky, but you can see, I hope, that it's a different view of this astonishing place. For instance, Antares, this red star, reddish star here, is surrounded by a nebula. And the nebula has been made by the star itself. One of the interesting things about stars, especially massive stars, stars more massive than the Sun, is that when they reach the end of their useful life, they swell to an enormous size, rather like some human beings we know. And and because they're very big, they also cool. And so their colour changes to a kind of orangey yellow colour like this. but because they're very big and very cool, in the outer parts of their atmospheres, from the great plasma, which is a star, simple elements begin to appear and simple compounds. For instance, this wispy stuff here might be carbon, or it could be titanium dioxide, or calcium oxides, or any one of a variety of so-called refractory materials, materials which are solids at very high temperatures. And these tiny particles are the dust, are the source of dust for many other objects which inhabit the Milky Way. So these dusty particles drift away from the star because the gravity at its surface is very low. They cool, drift up here, for instance, to cool, condense, and in there, inside them, the other stuff that this star is churning out, like oxygen and water and all the other stuff, that too cools and condenses on the surfaces and gives rise to these dark molecular clouds where new stars will form. Also gives rise to these reflection nebulae, because here there are a couple of bright stars nearby this dusty place and the light is being scattered by that dust, producing the blue reflection nebulae that you see there. So this is a useful and powerful way of showing rather interesting astronomical objects. The reflection nebulae are a specially interesting class of object. I think here I have another example of one. This is the beautiful Trifid or Trifid Nebula, Messier 20, some of you will know this as. A picture made with the Anglo-Australian Telescope with a series of techniques to emphasise the very faint stuff out here without losing the detail in the centre of the nebula. It makes a very striking picture, but also there's a good deal of astrophysics to be derived from images of this kind. For example, in the core of the nebula, right in the middle, there's a tiny group of stars, very much like the trapezium group in the Orion Nebula. The ultraviolet light from those stars is intense, and it covers a huge area of space. But here, there's a big cloud of hydrogen. In fact, the stars are embedded in a big cloud of hydrogen. And there's only so much ultraviolet light. And eventually, the ultraviolet light runs out. It's absorbed by the hydrogen, creating this roundish red nebula. Where it ends, we know that the flux, the amount of ultraviolet light, has reached a certain level. That's a very useful quantity to have in astronomy when you can't actually get it there with your light meter and do any serious measuring. So that sort of information, derived by looking at photographs and understanding the physics of what's happening, is really rather useful. Of course, the light is still blue, and it scatters from the dust particles, producing the reflection nebula which you see around the object. In the heart of the Trifid Nebula is this group of stars I mentioned before, rather like the trapezium group. They're intimately associated with this dust lane. And in fact, these stars have formed from this dust lane relatively recently. By that I mean in the last few million years. Now that sounds outrageous, stars being a few million years old, but it is recent, because the Sun is about 4,500 million years old. And with any luck, it'll go on for another 4,500 million years or so. These stars will only live a few tens of millions of years, not billions of years, because they're massive stars. They use their interior fuel, their nuclear fuel, very quickly, and they burn out in dramatic ways, as I shall show you later in this talk. Well, the Trifid is seen here in context. This photograph hasn't been treated with fancy copying techniques, but that's what the Trifid Nebula looks like before you fiddle with it. And it sits in a beautiful starry field, very near to another object, which is even bigger and better. And in fact, you can see this with the unaided eye tonight. It might be a bit bright around here, but if you go in the countryside in Australia, you'll certainly see this. This is the Lagoon Nebula, Messier 8, one of the pearls in the Australian winter Milky Way. I'm showing you this because in here there is a very active star-forming region for which I happen to have a new colour photograph. Oh, sorry, this is now the Lagoon Nebula after the plates have been copied to reveal the faint structure. And in this brightest bit here, there is a beautiful object called the hourglass, for obvious reasons, this hourglass shape. And this star here, it's one of the youngest stars known anywhere. Its age is estimated at something like 10,000 years or so. I think it's called Herschel 36. Is that right, Michael? This is where you've been poking around a bit in here. And I'm showing you this picture to show you now an infrared picture that David made. which shows much more detail. Now, when you look at this at first, you think, well, what a bit of a blurred mess this is. What's going on here? But in fact, there's much, much more information in this infrared picture, which David Allen made, than there is in my optical photograph. For a start, you can see many more stars, because we're looking through much of the nebula. You can see an extremely bright part of the nebula here. In fact, it's divided into two bits, because when stars form, they often form in places where there's they create within them a bipolar nebula, a nebula with two halves to it. So you don't see the actual star itself, but you see the two bits of nebula, which is the pinched waste of the hourglass. And you can see other structures in here which are quite invisible at optical wavelengths. So by comparing the two, you can derive very useful information indeed about these previously obscured and interesting objects. Well, another place where stars are forming is here. This is named, for obvious reasons, the Horsehead Nebula. And now we're looking at a very wide-angle picture again. This is a star-forming region. It doesn't look very interesting because most of the stars are hidden. But it's an area of prime interest for infrared astronomers, because they can poke around in there and reveal interesting things about new stars. I don't happen to have a picture of this in the infrared. But what makes places like this so interesting is, in a way, rather similar to what makes the cometary globule I showed you at the beginning of this talk interesting. Up here at the top of the photograph, there's a very bright star, Sigma Orionis. That bright star is illuminating a dark cloud, and this dark cloud is here, in the bottom part of the photograph. Notice there are fewer stars here than there are here. So there's something in the line of sight that's absorbing the light of distant stars, and it's a huge molecular cloud. It happens to have a rather flat surface, which is along here, and this star is illuminating that from above, as it were. The molecular cloud is being destroyed, gas is being released and ionized, photoionized, and produces this wonderful red nebula that you see here. And it so happens that sticking out of this dark cloud is a kind of fist-like object sticking out more or less in our direction, which just happens to have, at the moment, the shape of the head of a horse. If I was really clever, I could... The horse head, however, is very distinctive. And also distinctive is a star here. You don't see the star itself, but it's just caught up in the edge of this dusty cloud, not hot enough to produce the red nebula, but certainly enough light to produce a blue reflection nebula. So the horse head is being eaten away by energy from Sigma Orionis up here at the top of the picture. The brightest star in the image, Zeta Orionis, is a naked eye star. In fact, so is Sigma, but this is a very obvious one. This is one of the line of three that make up the belt in Orion. It's in the foreground and has nothing much to do with this nebula at all. But you have to admit, it makes a super picture. Well, if we look more closely at the Horsehead, you can see a lot of detail in it. This picture now taken with the Anglo-Australian telescope, you can see structures, for instance, through the chin of the horse and the mane of the horse here. There are subtle changes in colour where we're looking at the red nebula through bits of dust, telling you a good deal about the type of dust and the thickness of dust that we have in this part of the sky. Well, we remember the horse head because it looks like a horse head. It's a very distinctive shape. I mean, it's something you all know. But there are many other objects of this kind scattered through our Milky Way, all associated with star-forming regions, where this kind of mechanism is going on. Here is another example. Hot, bright star eating away at the surface of a molecular cloud and producing the red nebulosity here. And eventually, these hot stars, which have undoubtedly formed from this cloud in the relatively recent past, will eventually blow away all of this stuff. They'll destroy it, it'll be blasted to the other side of the galaxy, and eventually condense to form more stars again. But as it does so, it produces rather spectacular images like this. Here's another cloud. Down here somewhere is a bright star. So you can see the red tip of the molecular cloud that's being destroyed, and a great tail drifting off it. Eventually, it will completely disappear. Well, before it does, though, you might see something like this. One of these little blobs sitting on the sky. And if there was a star over here or over here off to one side that would blast one of these with ultraviolet light, you'd end up in an object like this with something like the cometary globule I showed you earlier on in this talk. Well, eventually, even these globules will disappear, the dust will be dispersed through the galaxy, and you're left with objects that look like this. This is a famous group of stars. It's the Pleiades. In fact, it's known, those of you who are familiar with Japanese cars will recognize this as a badge of a car. And in fact, in Japanese, this is known as a Subaru. This group of stars is very distinctive and well known to all kinds of civilizations around the Earth. The group of stars themselves are relatively young, a few tens of millions of years old, perhaps 100 million years old. The stars have drifted into a dusty place, and their light has been scattered by these wisps of dust between the stars. The wisps are wispy because the dust grains aren't round, they're very slightly elongated. And being bombarded by light as they are, they get a very slight electric charge on them. And of course, the electric charge always migrates to the ends of the dusty particles. There are magnetic fields between the stars, and so any charged particles will be aligned by those magnetic fields, just as iron filings are, for example. And that alignment is seen here in the wispiness of these lines. So these traces here are showing us magnetic fields between the stars. And you might think that they're very magnetic fields are invisible and elusive, and how on earth can you detect them several hundred light years away? Well, this image shows that indeed you can detect magnetic fields. And then the magnetic fields are not just ornamental. They play a very important part in the business of star formation, because as this dust condenses to form stars, the magnetic fields increase dramatically, and so magnetic fields are involved in the dynamics of the early stages of star formation.